This is a circumstance that occurs around the country. There has been insufficient investment in water storage, in water distribution, in all aspects of the water business. It wasn't a problem until it became a problem. Now it's a problem that will require trillions of dollars and many decades to fix. And there will be massive dislocations as a consequence of this. These are all questions that we're going to have to deal with. We don't get to postpone this anymore. We postponed it in the 70s. We postponed it in the 80s. We postponed it in the 90s. I remember the arithmetic around the discussions that I would have at times like this. And the response from every member of the community was, that's tomorrow's problem. Well, tomorrow's here.
This is Kaiser Johnson with Liberty and Finance, and this is the Miles Franklin Weekly Special for December 6th through December 13th, 2022, while supplies last. This week we have a double feature on Canadian maples. 2022 silver maples are just $6.25 over spot, while backdated silver maples are just $6.05 over spot, while this shipment lasts. Silver maples are produced by the famed Royal Canadian Mint, and were the first silver coins to be minted at 4/9 fine purity. And they remain one of the purest, most respected, and most recognized silver bullion coins today. Again, the 2022 silver maples are just $6.25 over spot, while backdated maples are $6.05 over spot. They come in tubes of 25, monster boxes of 500, and are IRA eligible. If you'd like to learn more about a precious metals IRA, call us, and we'll be happy to help you in that process. Our number for all orders is 1-888-81-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-815-4237. We're available after hours and on weekends, and we look forward to speaking with you.
Welcome back to Liberty and Finance. We're always delighted and honored to have this returning guest, Rick Rule, the former CEO of Sprott Asset Management, now the CEO of Rule Investment Media, joins us this Monday, December 5th, 2022. Rick, thanks for coming back on Liberty and Finance.
Always a pleasure, Dunnigan. Thank you for having me back.
I'm always brace myself, kind of like back when we used to live in Minnesota and you heard that a big winter storm was going to be coming, a nor'easter, and you're going to get hit with the snow. When I put out the call for questions for Rick Rule prior to your appearances here, I just get barraged with questions, and it's impressive. I mean, people really, really respect your experience and your opinion, and they seek it out. One of the things I wanted to talk with you about today, as we're visiting the South Western U.S. currently, with two new grandbabies having just been born, what a blessing, is this major drought affecting portions of the U.S. And there's certainly been some unusual climatic phenomenon here and there around the world, but this seems to be a big thing in the southwestern U.S. right now, is this idea of a long-term pattern of droughts, and this may be a part of a big one, because you've got reservoirs all over the place that are low, rivers that are low. It's affecting communities. Just this week, this past week, we saw a news show here locally that Scottsdale, Arizona, is going to cut off a neighboring community to whom they have supplied water, and they have 1 month to figure out an alternative plan. This other community does. So you've talked to us about many natural resources over the past, not just metals, also energy, and we haven't talked about water for some time. Could we start there today, because it's such an essential element of life, and we always talk about things that are vital on our program, people, so that they can make preparations. What are you paying attention to? What are the major trends you're following regarding availability of, scarcity of, trends with, et cetera, with water right now?
Water is a huge topic, Dunnigan, and you may know that I've been an investor in water rights and water companies for almost four decades, so I have some experience. I need to say at the beginning that in terms of investing in water, my favorite quip is that water is illiquid. The water markets don't trade very well, and it's difficult to buy and sell water rights or water stocks. But let's return to your question. The real problem with water in the West and the South and the Southwest is that water runs uphill to votes, not downhill to money. Water is regarded as a right. It's produced, distributed by government. It's allocated politically rather than by utility. The consequence of that in the West is that we use water for doing such brilliant things as growing rice and alfalfa in the desert. If water were rationed by price, which is to say that people growing alfalfa were competing with people who brush their teeth, there wouldn't be a long-running water shortage. There are other problems, too, with government control of a market that's as important as water. When the water in the West was allocated, particularly the water in the Colorado River Basin, it was allocated by the Army Corps of Engineers, who did a 10-year hydrological study. It isn't their fault that the 10 years that they chose had unusually high flows. The consequence of that, the water was allocated, by the way, as part of New Deal work in the Roosevelt area. The consequence of that is that with regards to the Colorado River Basin, between 115 and 120% of the median flow of the basin was allocated. It's very difficult if you order 150, if you, pardon me, seek to distribute 120% of the flow of a basin for the basin to continue to maintain adequate supply.
Do you mean to tell me that it's not just metals exchanges and banks and other things that have rehypothecation and fractional reserve issues?
Well, I don't think at the time it was allocated that the allocators anticipated the rapid growth of the West, and they certainly didn't understand, in all fairness, the hydrogeologists didn't understand that they were allocating based on 10 years of measurements that were unusually high. We're in a period now, of course, where we have unusually low precipitation. And having over-allocated the basin, given the demands for water in rapidly growing parts of the country, means that the crisis that many investors and many experts have talked about for decades is really truly upon us. Water isn't a problem until it is. Water is too cheap. And creating the infrastructure to distribute it is extremely expensive. Many people say, why don't we run an aqueduct from the Great Lakes to California? Well, using what for money to begin with? And secondly, how might the people around the Great Lakes feel about the distribution of their resource from a place that's cold and wet to a place in the South and the West that are warm or dry? So those are the type of issues we have. A different issue, of course, with, let's be polite and call it the communal allocation, the inefficient allocation of water, is that mostly water is handled by districts and municipalities. And they have very short-term, very political thinking. And so for probably 150 years, water distribution in the United States, I'm not talking about production and allocation and storage, but distribution has been handled by municipal authorities. And the problem with this is that in very large measure, the revenues from the distribution of water go into the general revenues category. And they can be used to invest, if that's the right phrase, in activities that can be reliably expected to generate votes. Near-term activities. The material underinvestment in water distribution in municipalities around the world is at critical levels. It is estimated, by the way, in New York City, that about half the water that enters the system in the Catskills is lost before it's distributed in New York City. I'm not picking on New York City. This is a circumstance that occurs around the country. There has been insufficient investment in water storage, in water distribution, in all aspects of the water business. It wasn't a problem until it became a problem. Now it's a problem that will require trillions of dollars and many decades to fix. And there will be massive dislocations as a consequence of this. One of the reasons that my wife and I left San Diego, California, San Diego County, California, there were many, by the way, but one of the reasons was that we were, as a community, reliant on the Metropolitan Water District of Los Angeles and on the Colorado River for our supplies of water. And our supplies of water on the Colorado River system were in third place behind the agricultural interests in the Imperial Valley, behind senior water rights accorded to states. So San Diego was in third place. That was okay when places like Phoenix and Las Vegas didn't have people living in them. But that situation has corrected itself over four decades. And the consequence of me living in San Diego, understanding that San Diego generated about 25% of its water, looked increasingly untenable. Now, I need to say that I lived in Carlsbad, California, where we were fortunate enough to have a very forward-thinking mayor. You know, I very seldom praise politicians, but in this case, Carlsbad, California invested $1 billion and built a desal plant in Carlsbad, California. So ironically, the only system in San Diego County that's in fact on secure footing is Carlsbad. But I digress. The truth around water comes from many, many, many facets. But the most important one is that water is allocated politically. It's allocated to votes. There isn't a free market in water. Were there a free market in water, agricultural water would command the same premium as industrial, commercial, and residential water, which is to say, in California, the farmers would be paying $1,200 to $1,500 per acre foot rather than $300 or $400 per acre foot. There is an enormous political benefit that goes to the agricultural interests in the West as a consequence of them being extremely powerful politically 50 years ago, 70 years ago, and 100 years ago. In the case of California, about 85% of the water that's used for human consumption goes to agriculture, contributing about 3% to the state GDP. I don't want to sound anti-farmer. By the way, I've been a farmland investor, so I've benefited myself from the incredible welfare allocated to farmers by the water system. But I need to say that you solve a problem of supply by price. And solving a problem of supply in water by price is regarded by voters as acting in a contrary fashion to what is popularly believed to be a human right. Unfortunately, when your water comes from the Colorado River, and when the Colorado River has been allocated as to 115% of its flow, somebody's rights are going to get trampled. That's just the simple arithmetic, particularly because people like to live in warm, dry places. So I hope that's a good introduction, Donegan.
Yeah, it's actually very good. You touched on a couple of things that I wanted to circle back on. One is that when we have had serious water issues in Northwest Ohio near Lake Erie, where the intakes for big portions of the state and the area of Southeast Michigan, Northwest Ohio, et cetera, are coming from Lake Erie, the water intakes there are affected by toxic algae blooms that can happen on a periodic basis depending on weather patterns, but also on depending on the amount of agricultural runoff that comes down some major rivers into there. And there are big battles between communities there who don't want to invest the big bucks that it takes to completely rework their water system. And you have these smaller communities that are recipients of processed water from the Toledo, for example, who say, oh, we're going to just go off on our own. We're just going to do our own thing. And then they look at the economics of it and they go, I guess we're not going to do our own thing. We're going to keep buying from you at whatever the cost is. But the reluctance of a major metropolitan area like Toledo, where they have serious issues with their roads, serious issues with crime, serious issues with urban blight, et cetera, revamping their water system always kind of gets a spit and a promise from, they'll put some more chemicals in this year or something like that, but they really won't completely rework that. So that whole dynamic that you talked about the fortitude that it takes to make serious investments in infrastructure with the hope and the expectation that this is going to have a multi-decade, improvement in people's lives and that sort of thing just never seems politically appealing. The second thing was the inefficiency of use that can be caused partly, in fact, I think, by the economics of it as well. We had a rare winter rain event here in the Phoenix area where we're visiting. And as we were out driving to get some supplies during the rain, the rare rain at this time of year, we saw your sprinkler systems watering commercial lawns and that sort of thing, just right in the middle of the rain. And just that, oh, well, they aren't sensitive to when the moisture is actually needed because it's cheaper just to just have them run on a timer or whatever. And passing entire subdivisions, entire subsections of the city that were built around man-made lakes, palm trees all over the place, all these unnatural, non-local, non-native species to transform the environment into something that people wish it were rather than what it is, which is a desert. Can you talk to us about any of the elements that are brought out there and how that affects water availability and water pricing?
It isn't my business to tell people how to live. If people in Las Vegas or Phoenix or Palm Springs want to live on a golf course, that's their business. But it's not my business to subsidize them. If the cost of the water required to sustain that standard of living was $1,500 or $2,000 an acre foot, which is to say if the residents of those communities had to pay the true cost of their lifestyle, they might in fact be more interested in conservation. Clearly, you wouldn't run a sprinkler system during a rainstorm if water were expensive rather than cheap. Nobody wants to pay the cost of water. They want somebody else to pay the cost of water. And politicians, too, as we've both described, are very loath to provide for infrastructure which will benefit people after their term is over. They are looking for politically expedient spending programs that will maintain their power and their ability to allocate resources. The situation that you describe in Toledo is, of course, by no means confined to Toledo. I don't know when the water system in Toledo was built, and I don't know the specifics of that locality. But my belief is that the revenues generated by that system were lower than they should have been if water had been priced at market and were allocated to expenditures that weren't designed to maintain water dependability and water security. My suspicion is that the system was underfunded because water was politically subsidized, and the money that the system did generate wasn't spent on securing water supply and stability for residents. Listen, we have wonderful, wonderful technology, wonderful engineering skills around water handling. We know how to solve these problems. The problem that you describe as an example with eutrophication, the process by which water becomes polluted by runoff and by subsequent algae blooms, is one that you can remediate through intelligent engineering, but you have to build a plant and you have to operate the plant. I'm not suggesting right now that you try and solve every problem at once, which is to say you eliminate or greatly reduce the runoff from nitrogenous fertilizer use in agriculture. I'm not beginning to fight that fight. What I'm trying to say is that if water was intelligently priced and there were returns on capital employed around water, that the circumstance that you describe, at least for the next 25 years, is a technological and capital problem. Similarly, in California, where I'm from, water was too cheap. And so we stored it in reservoirs out in the open because that was the cheapest way to store it. But in some reservoirs, like Glen Canyon, we lose 50% of the stored water to evaporation. It's much more efficient, actually, to either inject or allow water to percolate into the ground. It's more expensive, it takes up more ground, and you have to pump it out. But in fact, if water is priced at some number like $1,000 an acre foot, rather than some number like $40 or $50 an acre foot, the fact that you don't lose the water that you're going to use for human consumption when you store it underground and there's no evaporation means that underground storage is actually cheaper if you factor in resource waste. These are all questions that we're going to have to deal with. We don't get to postpone this anymore. We postponed it in the 70s. We postponed it in the 80s. We postponed it in the 90s. I remember the arithmetic around the discussions that I would have at times like this. And the response from every member of the community was, that's tomorrow's problem. Well, tomorrow's here.
You mentioned desalination, and my wife often brings this up when we hear about these drastic water shortages, especially affecting the high populations, southwestern U.S., California in particular. If you've got the ocean right there, why, in your view, maybe it has everything to do with everything you've just said, was a strategic program of desalination development not something that has happened? And is that an answer going forward?
I pointed out to our mayor in Carlsbad that desalination in terms of amortizing the capital costs and the operating costs, depending on the energy price, was about $1,000 an acre foot. Whereas at that point in time, the market clearing price for agricultural water in California was somewhere, depending on whether it was winter or summer, $50 an acre foot and $350 an acre foot. And the capital cost of moving what was hitherto agricultural water to San Diego was about $100 an acre foot, which is to say that desalination is an uneconomic alternative. What he pointed out to me was that he didn't have the political ability to cause a market to occur in California water, and that his choice was between paying $1,000 an acre foot for water or not having water. He told me with a very straight face that he thought the utility around this water was probably twice the cost of producing it from desalinization. Now, there are environmental issues around desalinization. You take the water in, you desalinate it, and you return that highly saline brine into the ocean, which can be environmentally very destructive. In order to mitigate that, you need to pump increasing amounts of salt water to dilute the brine, and you need to pump the brine into a place that's deep enough that the brine settles rather than permeating the rest of the culture, the rest of the coastal environment. Which is to say that desalination is an expensive alternative and a potentially damaging alternative. In the case of places like Southern California, with much more demand for water than supply, there are going to have to be technological adaptations and political adaptations around desalination, because the political impact of 100 years of underinvestment in water supply and the incredibly damaging political fact of the distribution of water by politics rather than by economics is so profound in a place like California that it's going to take 30 or 40 years to fix, assuming it gets fixed.
You said way back in the beginning something like water's not a problem until it is, or something like that. And it reminds me of, and this may seem like a gratuitous segue, but the concerns that people have expressed about availability of investable physical precious metals like silver, for example, when they see the stockpiles going down, down, down in the major exchanges, and in which categories registered versus these other categories that may be actually running out, to where something's got to give, the price has got to give, or the bookkeeping's got to give, and people have talked about rehypothecation as you did, that sort of thing. And then other people will comment, oh, there's plenty of silver, we got all you want, as deep as you want, as much as you want, that kind of thing. And it reminded me of a pot boiling and a pot boiling and a pot boiling, and it's not a problem, it's not a problem, it's not a problem. But if you leave the flame on, and as soon as the pot goes dry, I mean the moment the pot goes dry, big problem. And could you talk to us about that analogy and maybe the reality still on the water side, if there's more to be said about that, but how things that can be actually a clear and present warning, concern, danger, situation critical, didn't become that problem at the last moment, but it certainly can suddenly hit the public consciousness when that moment of, oh, we're out, hits.
I believe, Dunnigan, and I don't want to excuse myself from this criticism, I believe that people don't want to be responsible for their own well-being. They want to believe that the big thinkers, that the politicians, and that supply, that society will be responsible for their well-being. People want to believe that water as a human right will be supplied to them, and it will be supplied in such quantity and at such price as they find appealing. Similarly, retirees of my generation want to believe that the Social Security system is viable. Of course, we know it's grossly underfunded. We know it's going to run out of money. We know there's going to be dislocations in people's retirement. But until something becomes a problem, which is to say, until goods and services can't be politically supplied in such quantity, quality, and price as people find attractive, they want to believe that it's society's obligation to provide for them, until, of course, society can't provide for them. With regards to water, of course, I've been thinking about these issues, coming partly from a farming family, for many, many, many years. I live in Northwest Washington, where, in a very gross sense, water supply isn't an issue, except that I live on an island. I can't steal somebody else's water because it's too expensive. I have a well, that a fantastic well, generates about 8 gallons a minute. I run it at 2 gallons a minute. I do that because that well is 350 meters from the salt, and I don't want saltwater intrusion into a freshwater well. In addition to that, despite the fact that I live, or perhaps because I live, in a fairly high rainfall area, I have a rainwater capture system on my house. And that rainwater capture system feeds a 75,000-gallon reservoir. Now, this is a solution for me. It's a solution because I was fairly forward thinking about this issue as opposed to others, and also because I'm old and fat and rich. I was able to afford to do all of these things. Many people didn't have the expertise to be as forward thinking as I am and didn't have the financial resources to provide for their own water security. These same people, I suspect, at least many of them, didn't want to believe it was a problem because they were assured by the politicians that it wasn't a problem, and they didn't want to or were unable to plan for their own future. One of the things that strikes me, Dunnigan, as an example, grade portfolios, is that people's expectations of the future are really geared by their experience in the immediate past. And because there hasn't been a water problem for 40 years, in many people's minds, there isn't a water problem until they turn the tap to the right and air comes out. At which point in time, they say, what happened? This is the same with Social Security. Many people that listen to your show, and the people that listen to your show, I think, are unusually well-informed. Many of the people that listen to your show, when I describe the net present value of unfunded liabilities at the federal level, which is to say the federal trust funds, Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, the Congressional Budget Office's estimate of the net present value of unfunded mandated obligations and entitlement exceeds $100 trillion. $100 trillion. Now, we're addressing this imbalance by running a federal government where the deficit is $2 trillion a year. I discuss this publicly, and people say, oh, well, Rick, that's math. Just like the fact that the Colorado River was allocated as to 120% of its normal flow. That's math, too. The problem is that math comes home to become a problem eventually. And we're in that circumstance across many facets of the economy. By the way, we're going to get out of it. It's all going to be fine 30 years from now or 40 years from now. We have to get from here to there. I believe it was Churchill that said Americans always did the right thing when there were no other alternatives. We're getting to the point where there's no other alternatives. These problems can be solved with technology and knowledge that exists today. What we need is incentive.
About a year ago, I interviewed you and Keith Neumeyer of First Majestic Silver together, and the title of that interview ended up being Massive Metals Shortage Coming. And this is related to what we're talking about, where you can see, if you are paying attention to the dynamics underneath the hood, you can see the direction things are going and where we're going to end up long before we get there, before people suddenly say, oh, we're out. What happened? Do you see the same dynamic? And can you please take us into that, specifically in the metals arena?
I don't see the problem that same way. There is a shortage of retail silver. There's a shortage of 1 ounce material. There's a shortage of 3 ounce material. There's a shortage of 10 ounce material. My former employer, Sprott, where I'm still the largest shareholder, has absolutely no difficulty buying very large silver inventory, which is to say kilo and up. When the silver market returns to favor, it's not uncommon for $10 million or $20 million or $50 million to flood into the Sprott Silver Trust. And we are generally, although not always, able to deploy that money immediately and add inventories. But we aren't able to add inventories in retail denominations. We aren't able to add 30-gram product. We aren't able to add 100-gram product. Sometimes we have trouble even adding 1,000-gram or kilo products. So one needs to differentiate with regards to precious metals. The difference between wholesale-denominated product and retail-denominated product. In retail-denominated product, the demand, particularly U.S. demand, caught everybody completely by surprise. And it caught them by surprise during the period of time in COVID, when, as a consequence of COVID, the refiners who generally take wholesale quantities and make them into retail quantities shut down. The premiums that you are seeing in retail quantities, I suspect you would know better than I, Dunnigan, but I would suspect will continue for a while. But I would dispute the fact that there is an overall quantifiable silver shortage. People who are manufacturing solar panels are able to acquire ample silver and at very low markups to spot. People like Sprott, who are buying silver $10 million or $15 million at a clip, are still able to access reasonable silver supplies. It appears likely to me that the price of silver is going to go up, because as the refiner's capacity for melting down wholesale product and turning it into retail product begins to chip away at the availability and the supply of wholesale product, I think that you're going to see some of the premium in the silver market begin to be monetized in the spot and the wholesale market. But I've been wrong about that before.
You've been focusing on retail, retail investable product. I was looking at it maybe from a more macro standpoint, that I think you and Keith were talking about the big picture of metals availability versus the new green economy goals and that sort of thing, versus mining and exploration not having been languished for the last couple of decades, et cetera. Can you take that macro view for us momentarily?
Well, that is a problem. You know, we have, as you and I have discussed, Dunnigan, underinvested in exploration and development of extractive industries for a very long time. And the political headwinds in many parts of the world still mitigate against ensuring adequate supplies for humankind. One thing that's happening, and this is a wonderful thing, is that in the last 30 or 40 years, the living standards, the material living standards of the poorest of the poor on Earth have made remarkable gains. And this is wonderful. But 1.2 billion people on Earth still lack access to electricity, and they'd like it. As poor people, very poor people, acquire more disposable income, the purchases that add utility to their lifestyle are resource intensive. It might be conventional energy as a motor fuel. It might be a steel roof or a tin roof to replace a thatch roof. It might be cement walls to replace mud wattle. But the truth is, there's 8 billion people on Earth, and as the poorest of the poor increase their material living standards, they compete more and more with you and I for material well-being. In the face of this, for 30 years because resources have been too cheap, we've underinvested in resources. And there's going to be a reckoning. The reckoning will occur sooner or later. The determinant between sooner or later will, I think, come from, will we have a global synchronized recession or depression first? You can have supply shortfalls if you have demand shortfalls, because prices are set on the margin between supply and demand. So it doesn't necessarily follow that because, as an example, copper is in deficit, that the copper price has to go up if you reduce demand for copper temporarily. But you have to pay the piper over time. And we aren't paying the piper, partly for political reasons. There's a wonderful copper deposit in the state that you're in right now, in Arizona, called Resolution. Average mine grade for copper worldwide is about 0.5% per ton. The Resolution deposit is well over 1 billion tons at over 1.5% copper. A truly remarkable, remarkable deposit. And guess what? It's next to a copper mine. The infrastructure is there. There's roads, there's railroads, there's power, there's everything. This project now has been 20 years in permitting. A mine with three times the average grade, sitting next to a copper mine, alongside a highway, with easy access to power. The communities that live around it are populated by copper miners. And we can't permit it. This sort of circumstance, I think, presages perhaps a material shortage in extractive commodities that might resemble the water shortage that we're facing right now, if this continues. We are living, and I'll keep picking on copper because people understand that the electrification of the world will generate reliable demand for copper. We're living as a species on copper deposits that look a bit like me. They were discovered around the time I was born. They came into production around my adulthood. And to say that they're past their prime is an understatement. Escondida, the largest copper deposit in the world, largest copper mine in the world, pardon me, has been producing for 40 years. Ertsberg, Grasberg, 50 years. Bingham Canyon, 120 years. These deposits are long of tooth, and they need to be replaced. And we haven't done a sufficient job, with the possible exception, say, of Congo with Kamoa-Kakula, on a global basis in replacing the copper reserves and resources that we're depleting. But we don't believe we have a problem, because when we hit the switch, the lights go on. Until, of course, they don't.
We've got so many questions that have been submitted by viewers. I don't know where to start, and we're almost out of time. I'm going to ask one back to the question we were talking about as far as dynamics affecting metals. Fazadal asks, given that silver as an industrial commodity is shadowing silver as a monetary metal, does Rick still believe that, quote, gold moves first, silver moves further?
I delivered that statement not based on any economic knowledge, but rather on my memory. In the bull markets, the metals bull markets that I've enjoyed in my life, the primary motivator at the beginning of the market was fear. The ultimate mover was greed. So gold, a fear-based, insurance-based commodity, moved first. When the underlying momentum was established by gold, the lower unit price of silver and its volatility meant that it moved further and faster in the second stage of a bull market. I'm not talking about the economics of silver or the interplay between physical demand, which is to say industrial demand, and investment demand. I'm simply talking about my experience in prior bull markets without attributing any particular reason for them. I'm sympathetic to the fact that most of the gold that's ever been mined never got used. It got moved from a little hole in the ground called a mine to a different hole in the ground called a vault, where silver, about 1 billion ounces of it a year, disappears, although some of it gets recycled. And in theory, the fact that silver has industrial uses means that there should, over time, begin to be competition for investment demand from industrial demand. Whether that occurs or not is something that's above my pay grade. So when I discuss the fact that gold moves and then silver moves, it isn't based on any economic fundamentals. It's just based on my memory.
One last quick one before we give you a chance to let people know how they can reach out to you. Chef Sirius says, question, you have said that we should maintain cash liquidity. Why should we keep a cash position, especially when the value of this currency is decreasing day by day?
I love that question. I love that question. I know right where it comes from. Money that you keep in the bank is money where your purchasing power is declining on a monthly basis, certainly on an annual basis. And it is true that maintaining liquidity costs you purchasing power in the near term. My belief, however, is that the strains on the system may, I'm not saying will, but may result in a liquidity crisis. There may be a black swan event. They have occurred periodically during my life. There will certainly be a market clearing event in equities prices, perhaps as a consequence of higher interest rate. When there is a liquidity shortage, those people that have liquidity can take advantage of the circumstance rather than being taken advantage of by the circumstance. So the opportunity cost associated with not having cash is, in my opinion, higher than the degradation of the value of your savings. 2008, which was the last major liquidity crisis that we all experienced, was paradoxically a very good time for me. Because I had a lot of liquidity. And because I had the experience, I was willing to use that liquidity. The illiquidity that the markets experienced in 2008-2009 was my opportunity. It's important that people remember this statement. The decline in the purchasing power of your cash, of your liquidity, is an option payment on the ability to use your liquidity when other people don't have any. It's important to understand it in that context.
Makes sense. Before we go, I want to give you a chance to renew, if you wish to, any of the offers you have extended in the past to our viewers if they want to get some of your input on their personal natural resource investment portfolio, on Battle Bank, on private placements, anything that you have to offer.
Well, thank you for that. Love to talk to your listeners, and I encourage them to talk to me by offering for free to review your listeners' natural resource stock portfolio. Simply go to ruleinvestmentmedia.com, list your natural resource stocks. Please no crypto, please no narcotic stocks or tech stocks or anything like that, just resource stocks. And I'll rank them 1 to 10, but 1 being best, 10 being worst. I will also comment on individual issues where I think my comments have value. Note that this is a very popular service, and so I'm about 10 days behind right now. So be patient with me. In addition, as you know, Dunnigan, I'm celebrating retirement by starting a new bank, Battle Bank, an old-fashioned bank, one that has money in it, and one that lends against good collateral like gold and silver, one that doesn't trade in derivatives, as an example. If you care about our new bank, Battle Bank, at Rule Investment Media, in the question and comments section, write bank. Finally, as you know, I've given up my securities licenses, which means that I enjoy commercial freedom of speech, which is a very nice thing. If your listeners care about what I do with my own money, and if your investors are accredited investors, anybody who cares can get put on a list of the private placements that I'm participating in. Note that I don't participate in private placements unless I think they're outstanding opportunities, which is to say you won't be getting a notification every week. It might be 2 months or 3 months between the periods when I allocate. But if you're an accredited investor, if you are willing and able to take the risk associated with private placements, at Rule Investment Media, in the question and comments section, write placements, and I will put you on the list. And I will show you what I'm doing, when I'm doing it, and why I'm doing it. Note that just because I get into placement doesn't mean necessarily that you will get into placement. All I'm telling you is what I'm doing with my own money and why on a timely basis. So rankings, bank, placements. By the way, at ruleinvestmentmedia.com, not in the question and comment section on YouTube, at Liberty Finance.
Right. We'll put a link to that in the description of this video so people can go there and get to ruleinvestmentmedia.com. And Rick, As always, on behalf of all our viewers, first, let me thank all the viewers who submitted questions and apologize to the 99% who I didn't get a chance to ask their question. But thank you for being here with us, because I and all of our viewers learn every time we do have you on, and we're grateful for your presence here.
Well, always my pleasure. If you want to increase the frequency of these interviews and just do questions, I'm happy to do that.
I saved the list, so actually, if we can do that soon, that would be awesome.
Whatever you as the platform host wants to do, I'm at your service. I enjoy the process.
Thank you, Rick, and thanks everyone for watching. Please share this widely. And Rick, thanks for joining us again on Liberty and Finance.
Always a pleasure, Dunnigan. Thank you.
Miles Franklin Precious Metals is one of America's oldest and most trusted bullion dealers. Miles Franklin is A-plus rated and accredited by the Better Business Bureau, licensed and bonded, and has zero complaints ever registered. Here at Liberty and Finance, we are licensed brokers with Miles Franklin. To order, simply call us, discuss your needs, and we will let you know our live inventory, prices, and availability, and lock in your order over the phone. Once your order is locked, the price is held for you regardless of market fluctuations, and the metals are reserved for you awaiting your settled payment. Within one business day of ordering, you will receive an email invoice detailing the order and payment instructions. Miles Franklin accepts payments by bank wire, ACH or electronic check, money order, check mailed priority mail, and cryptocurrency. The fastest forms of payment are bank wire and cryptocurrency. Upon settled payment, metals will ship out within 3 to 5 business days. You will receive tracking information via email. Domestic shipping charges are $15 for any order under 500 ounces of silver or 10 ounces of gold. For orders larger than that, domestic shipping is free. The package will be double boxed, fully insured, and labeled discreetly, with no indication of the contents inside. For your privacy, the name Miles Franklin will not even be on the package. To talk to myself, Elijah, my brother Kaiser, or my father Dunnigan, call 1-888-81-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-815-4237.